You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is episode 78, covering the week of June 26th through June 30th, 2017. I am your host, Brian McClanahan. And before we get started with the material for the week, just want to remind everyone of a few things. First and foremost, if you like this podcast, please share it around on social media. You can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, and like our YouTube page. Also, just want to remind everyone about our website and the wonderful material we have there. If you're not familiar with it, we do have well over 100 lectures for free from our conferences on our webpage. Our YouTube channel has dozens of our lectures that we've given at our conferences and summer schools over the years, plus this podcast every week. We do put that on our YouTube page as well, so you can share it around there. Also, our Facebook page is very active, so if you would like to go on out there and like us on Facebook, you will find all of our daily material on Facebook. And that said, if you do like everything that we do, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. It will help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. It will help keep this podcast going, the website up and running, and all of our programs. And if you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, you can give us an email address, and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sayles, Emancipation Hell. And not only that, you'll get our daily dose of Dixie and our weekly email. So all those wonderful things that we have for free that we do for you. We also have the Jim McClellan Library, which is a huge primary source library for free as well. So there's a lot of free stuff out there, a lot of free material. Our website has become a virtual Southern library in the last 3 years that we've had it going in the new format. So also want to let everyone know that starting next week, and we've been doing this now for several weeks, but officially starting in July, the Abbeville Review will be dedicated exclusively to book reviews. And so if you are listening to this podcast and you are interested in writing book reviews for us, you don't have to buy the books. We provide the books for you. And you just have to give us your information, your credentials, and your background so we can take a look at it and see if you would be fit for the Abbeville Institute in reviewing books. You can send that information to our new book review editor, Ryan Walters. His email address is walters@abbevilleinstitute.org. So go on over there and do that if you are interested in writing reviews. So once a week, we will have a book review, usually and hopefully on new material. We've got several ready to go starting next week, and we'd like to keep that going throughout the year. So that is one way that we can keep up on current literature, on whether it's history, philosophy, politics, whatever the case may be, art, music, literature. So all of those things are important to us. And of course, getting information out there about new books, things that you should be reading to help, again, explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Okay, all of that said, let's get into the material for the week. So we had a lot of good material this week. We started off with an article by Carl Jones entitled "The AP Gets It Wrong Again." And of course, this should be like a broken record. The AP always gets it wrong. In this particular case, you had a AP writer named Jay Reeves write a piece entitled "Old South Monument Backers Embrace Confederate Catechism." And so the Confederate Catechism, for those who don't know, was written by Lyon Gardner Tyler. And Lyon Gardner Tyler was the son of John Tyler, and he actually was the president of the College of William and Mary. So he wasn't a nobody. You know, this guy was a pretty important historian. And in fact, at our summer school, our 15th annual summer school, which is coming up in just a couple of weeks, I'll be giving a talk on Lyon Gardner Tyler and Southern historians of that particular period of time. But the author, Reeves, was, quote, "astonished by the audacity of Southern historians and Southern people in general who would reject today's scholarship." And so Carl Jones, who is the recipient of our Robert E. Lee Award at our annual banquet last year, who's written a number of great things for the website, he wrote this little piece, and he was actually interviewed for it. The Reeves had contacted several members of the SCV, and Carl being one of the upper-ranking members of the SCV, did the interview. And Carl does a very nice job in taking apart this particular piece. And so he starts by saying, first of all, there was no monolithic entity known as the South that seceded. 13 independent states issued ordinances of secession, and for varying reasons, 11 of those seceded. And he says, you know, why assume that Mississippi spoke for all 13 states? And of course, when you try to conflate issues and try to make 19th century issues 21st century issues, you run into all kinds of problems. And that's generally what historians try to do today. They take a 21st century moralistic view of history and they try to apply that to the 19th century, and it just doesn't work. And so Carl Gitz does a very nice job in pointing out that Missouri didn't say anything about slavery and their secession ordinance. And of course, the fact is the founding generation, even Alexander Hamilton, spoke of secession or the ability of the states to check the power of the general government should it exceed its constituted authority. And so this is very important to understand, that secession in 1860 and 61 was nothing new. People had talked about it over and over again. People had talked about it in the North several times before 1860. In fact, the earliest case was 1794, when Rufus King and Oliver Ellsworth cornered John Taylor of Caroline in a cloakroom in the Congress and said, look, John, this thing isn't working. Let's get out of the Union. And so that is something that most people don't realize. And of course, secession was brought up by the North again after the election of Thomas Jefferson, then again after the Louisiana Purchase, then again after the War of 1812. It was brought up by abolitionists over and over again. And you wonder why, if the issue was all about slavery, why the North wouldn't have been happy to allow the South to go. If the issue was about abolishing slavery and getting rid of the appendage of the Union that was so morally incompatible with the rest of the Union, then these abolitionists should have been fine with the South getting out of the Union. But that wasn't really the case. In fact, Lincoln never made it about slavery until that became a war aim. So Carl continues, no serious historian would deny that Northern assaults on slavery were a cause of secession for some states. But again, secession is not an act of war, and one must frame the situation in the context of the time. And of course, historians rarely do so. He concludes by saying, but here's the real issue. Mr. Reeves was not attempting to undertake a fair, honest, or reasonable look into what compelled the South or why the Confederate Catechism may forward legitimate arguments. And I think that's the important thing about it. Basically, what Reeves was doing is taking this catechism and saying, look at this archaic thing. It was written in the early 20th century. It's just lost cause propaganda. How can any fool still believe this thing? He probably never read the Confederate Catechism. And when I do my talk in Charleston, I'm going to talk about catechisms in general. The fact is that in the early 20th century and late 19th century, catechisms were a very popular pedagogical technique that were used all over the United States in all levels of schooling. People would recite and memorize certain facts about history. And Tyler's catechism was not that much different from another very popular catechism that was being used at the time in schools across the United States, not just in the South, but in the North as well. So it's not unusual for these catechisms to be there. And of course, today when you say, well, we don't, you know, rote memorization is not what we do in the United States anymore. And so people have a problem with that. But this is the point. The arguments in the Confederate Catechism were legitimate. Lon Gardner Tyler was a very good historian. He wrote a wonderful little essay defending his father from attacks by the press at the time. Time Magazine actually wrote an attack on John Tyler and compared him, you know, unfavorably with Abraham Lincoln. And so Tyler responded by comparing Lincoln with Tyler and showed that Tyler was actually the superior president, it's a great article. Carl concludes then, like most modern writers and most modern scholars, he was simply trying to gain favor with the ever-diminishing handful of leftist myrmidons who still pay attention to today's press. A lot of people aren't. I mean, the press is not reliable. People are realizing the press lies. They don't trust it. And so when people do pay attention to it, it's like an echo chamber. And people might say that about, of course, what we do. We're in an echo chamber. Only the people that like us listen to us. And I don't necessarily think that's the case. We do have people that respond to our material that don't like us and don't like what we do. Sometimes they're trying just to pick a fight. But the fact is, the reason that we exist and the Abbeville Institute exists and we do this podcast and we have this website is to try to put this information out there so there is a counterweight to the very mainstream and establishment perspective on the war and on American history in general. So this is a very good piece, short piece, but Carl does a very good job of taking down Mr. Reeves. On Tuesday, we had another book review, and this one was written by Loxley Nichols. It actually appeared in Southern Partisan magazine in the late 1980s. And it's a review of David Herbert Donald's Look Homeward, which is a biography, essentially, of Thomas Wolfe. Thomas Wolfe was an eccentric Southern author, and when I say eccentric, I mean, I think that's putting it nicely. And the question might become, why should we read Thomas Wolfe? And I think that that's a valid question. When you look at who Thomas Wolfe was and the fact that he wasn't the most savory of characters, but Dr. Donald, as Loxley Nichols says, does a particularly nice job in detailing and analyzing Wolfe's relationship with Maxwell Perkins, and those sections are perhaps the strongest in the book. He also captures other figures in Thomas Wolfe's life. And what I think what this piece does particularly well is at least give Wolfe a fair shake in why we might want to read a book about Thomas Wolfe or read Thomas Wolfe in general. You know, David Donald is a Southerner. He was a very prominent historian at Harvard University. And he was very much impressed by Wolfe's work when he was a young man in describing the South. As Mr. Nichols writes, while we may not yet be ready to accept Dr. Donald's proposal that Thomas Wolfe was a great writer, we are nevertheless inspired to take a second look. And so I think these are some of the things that we think about. You know, should we take a second look at various authors, Southern authors, who might, you know, inspire something in us, or at least be someone who would be worthy of maybe a second reading. Donald said, and when he read Look Homeward, Angel, he said, quote, I was convinced without any just cause that I too was misunderstood by my family and underappreciated in my community. And like Eugene, I enjoyed writhing in romantic agony. So, you know, Wolfe does have some attractive elements to him if you are an adolescent, as he says, you know, and a lot of people do. So maybe, you know, Thomas Wolfe deserves maybe a second look, or at least under another a deeper understanding. And so perhaps you might want to read David Donald's biography of Look Homeward, which is about Thomas Wolfe himself. So this is it was a nice little piece. And then on Wednesday, we ran a piece entitled Rehumanizing Johnny Reb, written by Travis Archie. Now, Travis Archie had written a nice little piece for us before about Missouri and the war. And this little piece, he calls it just his rant. And he begins with a quote from a popular television show, which was entitled How I Met Your Mother. And it ran in 2008. And the quote is, you said he's a Confederate general. They're the bad guys, and he's probably racist. We're going to raise our kids here. I don't want some Confederate general ghost teaching them his racism. And so this is the common way that Confederate soldiers are described. They're simply just caricatures. They're just something, a straw man you can take and knock down. They don't have any depth. They're not real people. Think about, and I mentioned this years ago when I was doing a talk at the Stephen Dale Lee Institute. And I said, you know, the problem is not the way Confederate soldiers are portrayed in, say, Glory, for example, or some of these other films, you know, Gettysburg. The problem with the way Confederate soldiers are portrayed is something like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Slayer, where Confederate soldiers are not even human. They're vampires. They're subhuman. And I think that's what people are really starting to view Confederate soldiers as today. And that is the real issue here. These people aren't human. They're less than human. They shouldn't even be respected in any way. This is why you can vandalize their monuments, spit on them, and destroy them, topple them, whatever the case may be, because these people aren't even real people. And when you go back and you look at the way, for example, Thomas Nast, who was a German cartoonist in the 19th century, the way he portrayed the Irish, Thomas Nast was a German 48er, these communists who came over to the United States and supported the Republican Party. That was Nast. And he portrayed the Irish as apes. And that was fine, because at the time, people thought the Irish were essentially less than human. They were just drunks and thugs, and they could be portrayed in any way you wanted. And in essence, this is how Southerners are now portrayed in modern America. That the only people that can be picked on, vilified, demonized, essentially classified as less than human by the Comedy Central channel, modern-day comedians, whatever the case may be, the South is the only section that can be the punchline of every single joke. And Confederate veterans aren't even real. They're just subhuman. People that just need to be demonized and pushed into the dustbin of history. As Archie says, all too often, even those who sympathize with the Confederate soldier can find themselves inadvertently forgetting his humanity. We must remember that this statistic was a living, breathing human being with a quirky personality and character flaws. He had hopes, dreams, hobbies, and a sense of humor. He was white, black, Hispanic, Native, or Asian. At different times, he was hungry, thirsty, bored, cold, scared, depressed, homesick, or terrified. He loved and missed family, friends, and his sweetheart. He prayed, sang, wept, laughed, hunted, fished, and got into his fair share of mischief. He talked of liberty, self-government, defending his home. He was a farmer, a lawyer, a tradesman, or a merchant. He was a son, a brother, a husband, an uncle, a cousin, and most important to his descendants, he was a father. So what Archie is saying here, we need to remember these people were people, just like us. They had their faults. They had their good traits. And so as we rehumanize these people, I think it makes it, it brings it home that when you tear down the monuments of these people, you're tearing them down too. You're tearing down their descendants. You're tearing down their blood. Most Southerners who have been here for generations, particularly if you've been here from generations, have Confederate soldiers in your bloodline. You're tearing them down. You're making them less human. And so Archie demands that you go out and read the primary letters, diaries, letters, the things that Johnny Reb, quote unquote, wrote. Don't let some professional historian interpret it for you. Read what he had to say. And he says, it certainly hits close to home when you think of history as a vast collection of individual experiences rather than leaders, statistics, and grand campaigns. And that's true. If we look at the common soldier, and there have been a number of very good books written on the common soldier in the Confederate Army. One of the best, in fact, is a book entitled Lee's Miserables, Life in the Army of Northern Virginia from the Wilderness to Appomattox, written by J. Tracy Power. It is a fantastic look at what it was like to be in Lee's army in the last year of the war. And I'd highly recommend that book. So there's a lot of good stuff out there. But again, go read the primary material yourself, and I think you'll find that these soldiers are human. And that's something we need to remember when we're talking about battlefield statistics, who these men were and why they were memorialized to begin with, why these women would go out after the war is over and want to have a yearly, an annual event that honored these men who served in that army. Remember, 75% of the white Southern population fought in the war. 75%. 3 out of 4. And so these men were worth remembering. It wasn't about putting on some display of emotion or about codifying some form of government or society. It was truly about remembering 75% of the white population that had fought in the war and had suffered the deprivations that they suffered. And now we're going through Reconstruction and all the other things. So it's important to remember those things. On Thursday, we published a piece entitled Dixie Side, written by Dissident Mama. And she wrote a piece for us a few weeks back. And this is a continuation of that. And we will run the third part next week. But she gets into this idea that, as Tom Fleming had said very well in one of our conferences, this is essentially a cultural genocide. And Eugene Genovese had said the same thing at one point. She said, today's removing Confederate symbols in New Orleans, changing the name of Jefferson Davis Highway in Arlington, or attempting to relocate the remains of Nathan Bedford Forrest. So tomorrow it's going to be something else. If there's no resistance, maybe soon it'll be carting off quote-unquote neo-Confederates to Southern Poverty Law Center camps. She calls it Jacobin thuggery or cultural genocide. She defines genocide as a constant unfolding, a concerted effort that is always testing and moving forward the goalposts for what is deemed acceptable for the day. And this goes back to Clyde Wilson's piece on Who Are the Real Nazis? And when you look at what's going on with the left and how they're attacking Confederate memorials and other things. I mean, it's plaques now. It's historical markers. It's not just memorials. It's anything doing with the Confederacy. And where are they going to stop? We know that NOLA, or Take 'Em Down NOLA, has said they want the Andrew Jackson statue gone. They want George Washington gone. I mean, heck, these guys are slave owners. They need to go too. So this is the real issue. This is just the opening salvo in a very serious cultural war. What is America going to look like in 50 years should these type of attacks keep going, and their natural conclusion would be to tear down all of American history prior to, say, 1975? What are you left with? I mean, this is exactly what the Marxists did in the French Revolution. This is exactly what the Marxists did in the Cambodian Revolution, the Khmer Rouge. When you start with year one, are you going to do that? Where do you stop with this particular type of action, with these attacks? Do they stop at Confederate, the low-hanging fruit, which are Confederate memorials, statues, symbols? Or do they keep going? And I think the answer is clearly they're going to keep going. But where do Americans wake up and say, wait a second here, we shouldn't even let them get the first piece of fruit off the tree? But the aim is to eradicate any semblance of Southern cultural identity. Now, of course, they would say, we don't want to do that. We like Southern food. We might like some Southern music. We might like Southern architecture, maybe. But those things now, we like SEC football. But that's not really, I mean, those things are part of the South, without a doubt. Southern food, Southern music, these things are great. But what about the entire Southern tradition? Genovese said, you know, the point about studying Southern history is to learn what you can from these people. There are good things, there are excellent things you can learn from these people, and we should do that. Don't just make them as a symbol of disdain, but what are they actually saying that's true and valuable? And this is exactly what we're doing in the Abbeville Institute. You know, Genovese, his words have been a great inspiration for the Institute and what we should be doing here. You can't ignore the bad in a tradition. There's bad there. But you can also pull out the good, and you can do that effectively and still teach people how to live. This is what Richard Weaver said in his Southern Tradition at Bay. We don't want to live in the Old South, but we want to learn from the Old South parts of it that really taught us how to live well. There were good things in the Old South. There were things in the 21st century you don't find favorable. But this is what traditions are about. This is why you do it. This is why you try to conserve certain things. So I think that's the important thing about when we look at, you know, when people are saying we want them to stop with these attacks on our monuments and our history and our character, the character of our people. Because what you're essentially doing is removing those things from society. If you take a monument down, there's not even a discussion about it anymore. At all. So it's a wonderful little piece. And then on Friday, we ran a piece entitled Free People of Color in Dixie. This was written by Barbara Marthal, who has presented at our conferences before. And she does a very good job of telling the story of, as she calls them, free people of color. Free blacks in the South. And she talks about how this was a large percentage of the population. Of course, I was reading a little book about, she brings up urban centers, and I was reading a little book about the Mississippi River and when it wasn't all dammed up. And the book gets into New Orleans and how around New Orleans, and she, Barbara Marthal does a nice job of talking about this too, how many people in New Orleans were of, as she calls them, free people of color. And they made money. They had property. They were well-to-do. She often cites a book entitled Black Property Owners in the South that gets into this, that there was a large number of black property owners in the South. And this is kind of an untold story of Southern complexity. And so Barbara does a very good job of bringing this out. And she has 5 points that she says people don't often focus on. Number one, within the southeastern United States, more times than not, our ancestors found ways to work together to successfully build a strong society committed to freedom. Two, initially bonded servants from Africa were treated much the same as bonded servants from Europe. They were given their freedom after a designated number of years of service. She says, true, some heinous masters did not honor the terms of their contracts, and many black indentured servants never obtained their freedom, but that was also true of white indentured servants. Number three, the success that people of African descent had in gaining their freedom during colonial antebellum times. They built strong families that contributed to the growth and wealth of American society. This is often not discussed. In fact, there's a study of the slaves in South Carolina during the Yemassee War, and I think I brought this up on the podcast before, and how these people were armed. They were frontline soldiers. They were armed. And that was in the early 18th century. Number four, the success of many slaves in creating enough wealth to purchase their freedom or to own businesses and dominate the service and mechanical industry, as slaves, particularly in the southeastern United States. And this is true. They did that. And I think that's something, again, kind of a lost history here that people don't realize. They just use these platitudes and, when I call them half-truths or popular culture truths is more than anything to describe what Southern society was like before the war. And then five, the majority of the population in key Southern port cities and throughout the countryside were of African descent, which means they dominated and reaped a portion of the benefits of the wealth and put those port cities in country and of those port cities in countrysides. And so this is true. I mentioned New Orleans. You had that in certain areas where you had large percentages of black Americans, both free and slave. And there was this, even historians have recognized that even right after the war, there wasn't really any segregation. C. Ben Woodward in his The Strange Career of Jim Crow pointed that out. After the war, there really wasn't any segregation. This was something that was going on. You didn't really have it before the war because people had to intermingle all the time and mix all the time. So you didn't have that like you had in the late 19th and early 20th century. That was very much a creation of the progressive movement. And Woodward says that the progressives in some ways were the old conservatives. And I think I can buy that argument in some ways. But I think that what he misses, and what most people miss, is, again, the complexity of Southern political thought in that early New South period. So Barbara does a very good job of pointing these things out. And of course, this is history that you're not going to get most times. You know, there was a much more complex cultural diversity to the South, economic diversity, that you just don't find in your textbooks because it's going to be your pop culture narrative. And that's unfortunate because I think by bringing this history out, as Eugene Genovese has pointed out in Roll Jordan Roll, it makes Southern society more complex, and it's not divisive. it's in so many ways healing to talk about these things and look at the good and the bad. There is good in Southern society too, and I think that's what Barbara does a very good job in talking about. Okay, so I hope you enjoyed the material we have for this week. If you are going to the summer school, that's in a couple of weeks from now, so maybe we'll see. I'll see you there. And remember, again, please share our material around, share the podcast around, share our articles around, and help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Until next time, good day.